Bonsoir. Good evening. I'm glad you're all here. I wish I were. Tonight is the Lost Clause. As it turns out. And the subject is crazy wisdom, which is way over our heads. It's way beyond us. Starting point is hopelessness, which is way beyond us. However, we've been taught this, so we're free to discuss it, I suppose. And it was taught as a manual for Buddhas, and in this case, the featured Buddha was Padmasambhava, as we called him, Guru Rinpoche, as he's perhaps more frequently known. So, in case I lose it and get confused, I want to tell you in this large-scale non-conceptual universe, I want to tell you right at the beginning what it's about, so it won't be a total loss. And the first thing is dropping the reference point of ego. That's number one. And number two is riding the energy that's liberated, the non-dual energy and intelligence that's liberated by dropping the reference point of ego. So, if you get the dropping the reference point of ego and nothing else, that's worth just about everything. So I thought I'd, as I did the previous talk that I gave, I'd like to give you a little background about the historical background. These talks on crazy wisdom that Rinpoche gave are both from 1972, and one of them was in Jackson Hole, Wyoming. The other one was at Carmi Chilling, and they were the among the last talk, or towards the end of his first period in North America, which was the period in which he was giving teachings on the sudden path. His teachings were all the whole bowl of wax at once. Everything was there on the spot. Even beyond the level of all the teachings that we usually associate with Tantra, although same time you could say it's the essence of Tantra, but still beyond the level of Vajrayana that we usually associate with mantra and mudra and yidams and deities and so on. Because this is the crazy wisdom action of Padmasambhava. And yet he taught it to us and many other things in those first years that he was in North America. And oddly enough, changed his style in 73 when he gave the first seminary and actually introduced Vajrayana formally, but at the same time, a nine-yana path that enabled gradual teachings situated stage by stage. But before that, it was the whole blazing meteor hitting at once, constantly, again and again. And I remember the night before he gave the first of these talks. I think there were 13 of them altogether in the two seminars. The first one at Jackson Hole, we were in retreat. Few of us in retreat with Rinpoche in the backwoods of Massachusetts. And we'd been there for a while. And there were usually two or three of us, but three or four more people had arrived, I think, as I recall, to conduct Rinpoche to Jackson Hole to give these teachings. And he was to leave the following morning. The car had to leave 5 or 6 in the morning for the airport. And on the following day, so we were sitting around. There were enough people. We were sitting in the dining room, which was a rare thing. 5 or 6 or maybe 7 people. And it was maybe 4 or 5 in the afternoon by the time we'd gathered there, and we sat and talked for a couple of hours, and then Rinpoche decided to go up and have a bath. So he went up, and if I recall, it was a Carl Springer who went up to assist him in the bath, and we were sitting there at the table for an hour or so, the rest of us. Springer came down, said, well, an hour later, he said, well, he's still in the tub. And we were getting bored and hungry. Another hour went by. Springer came down, and he's still in the tub. So we were pretty irritated, but making the best of it. And about an hour later, Springer came down and said, he's going to get out of the tub soon, he says. So maybe a half an hour of that, after that, he came down and he said, he's getting dressed. And who knows, maybe a half hour, 45 minutes after that. All in all, maybe it was about 5 hours. He finally came down and he was beautifully, beautifully dressed in a coat and tie, everything fastidiously arranged, and looking absolutely gorgeous, as he sometimes did, not rarely. And so we were hoping to sat down at the end of the table, and we were hoping to have dinner. But instead, he started to tell us about a dream that he'd had the night before. And the dream was about the devil's daughter. and he was having some kind of scene going on with the devil's daughter. I don't remember the details. I couldn't follow it at the time, but it was a very detailed account, blazingly vivid with little details, and he was blazing extraordinary power. And it was maybe for that reason that it was difficult to follow exactly the story he was telling, because the atmosphere was so powerful that you'd kind of lose the thread of your attention often, as though you were nodding off into non-conceptuality. So, if you call that nodding off. In our case, I think it was pretty close. And so, after about well over an hour of the devil's daughter, we finally had dinner, which took another 2 hours. By then it was maybe 2 in the morning, and we sat at the dining room table for another 3 hours talking, and then he said, well, I guess it's about time to go. So the people that were going got in the car with him, and off they went to the airport, and he got to this Jackson Hole mid-afternoon, and he didn't go to bed at all. I don't know if he changed clothes, but it looked to me like he was dressed for the talk the night before. I don't remember if I heard that he changed clothes or not. But anyhow, and then he began giving these extraordinary teachings. And I thought it might be worthwhile clarifying a little bit more specifically, because one of the things he did in these, one of the many subjects he covered in these 13 talks, was about the sudden and the gradual path. And the difference between the gradual path and the sudden path. The gradual path, there's some carrot. There's some stage that you're at, and some sense of a stage you can attain. And so a sense of a journey from point A to point B, or however many points. And if you look at the gradual path from the point of view of crazy wisdom, although we sometimes call it things like Hinayana, Mahayana, and Vajrayana, from the point of view of crazy wisdom, it could all be regarded in some absolute sense of spiritual materialism. Whereas the sudden path, instead of there being a path and a goal, path being the doctrine and the goal being the attainment, there's the path itself is the goal, which that means that every moment of nowness is the whole thing, and that's all there is. So that was the atmosphere he was emanating at the time. It's very difficult to go through all the points about a crazy wisdom that he did describing the career, so to speak, of Padmasambhava. So I've decided to have a bash at providing the core teaching as best I can, which I apologize for that. Not very good. So the point, as I said before, the first point is dropping the reference point of ego. And the best start for that is to recognize that we're making history every moment. That is to say, there is no such thing as history. But as you all know, but at each moment we're creating a reference point of past, present, and future. Hence, we're constantly making history. And if you're a bit of an accomplished practitioner, you can sense how you are doing that at this very moment. Somehow or other, you have a projection of being here in this room and being you with a past, present, future. And there's a certain tension on the focal point of that projection of being here, and you've practiced it, you can feel that slight tension, and then you can drop it. You can let it go. And then you have a kind of a gap. Which is the Dharmakaya. And we have a lot of teachings that I don't know how accomplished people are, how much experience they have, but we have some lots of teachings about dropping reference point. We have some very advanced ones, relatively speaking, which I thought I would just pass through. Usually, to get some kind of practice and a feeling of dropping reference point, which is important, ploy is to recognize that sense of reference point and intensify it so that you can feel what it's like to let it go. For instance, as some people here well know, the Maitri theater practices had I guess what you might call muscular intensifications, followed by rapid or abrupt dropping of the tension, letting it go. Is that right? Which turned out to be very interesting. And in various sampanakramas, in sadhana practices, before you enter the sampanakrama, you intensify, you reduce the visualization to a seed syllable. You intensify the sense of the seed syllable, then you concentrate the seed syllable, and then you pop it. And in the Ashe practice, you intensify the whole stroke from the beginning, and down to the bottom, intensifying and intensifying until you get to the bottom where there's a sudden abrupt upstroke which busts the whole thing. So those are some of the many examples that you find throughout the teaching for practice of dropping reference point. But the most basic one of all, and universal one of all, came in Rinpoche's teaching in the basic meditation instruction. Which, just for the fun of it, I'll go through that basic meditation instruction very briefly. There was the physical part, which is essentially that you sit up straight, but not exaggeratedly straight, and you keep your eyes open. And then there's a breathing technique, as you know. As Rinpoche gave it the first years, identify with the out-breath. As the breath goes out into the space of the room, allow yourself to go out with it and dissolve into space. So there's one. Dropping a reference point. You don't particularly pay attention to the out-breath because at the end of that in-breath, because at the end of the out-breath there's a gap. So Rinpoche used to sit there and he'd say, out, dissolve, gap. Out, dissolve, gap. And then there's the thing about thinking that of course, you're not able to stay with the breathing technique. So, you drift off. Your attention drifts. And the instruction is, whenever you notice that you've drifted off into thinking, which also includes emotion, then you label that thinking. And you go back to the out-breath. And he often used to add in early years, there are no VIP thoughts. VIP, everybody knows VIP, very important, special treatment person. So there are none of those, there are no VIP thoughts. Maybe you just realize that you're gay. Even so, you label that thinking and you go back to the out-breath. Maybe you just realize that your partner is cheating on you. Not only cheating on you, but with that certain particular despicable so-and-so van. Even so, even that is not a VIP thought. You let go of your thought and you return to the out-breath. Maybe you just realize that you're going to run out of money on July 11th, 2012. Doesn't matter. You drop it. There are no, absolutely no VIP thoughts. It's absolute. It's complete. It's an utter, utmost, complete, total teaching. There are no VIP thoughts. So, the idea of no VIP thoughts can take us a long, long way. If you are a real practitioner and you heed that dictum in your everyday life and are willing to surrender all of your VIP reference points as they arise, then that takes you quite a long, painful, kick in the gut way through ego toward egolessness. And as you drift in the direction of egolessness, Rinpoche once said it's like an operation without anesthetic. So it can be quite painful. And you begin to give up hope. You move toward hopelessness, which is given as the starting point for the crazy wisdom teachings. Rinpoche used to sit there and say, "It's helpless. It's completely helpless. There's no hope. There's no hope. It's completely helpless." He did. At such times, that particular energy touched on the quality of crazy wisdom which he was always purveying, but particularly nakedly in those early years. Of course, we have to. Punks like me have to. And we, most of us, have to wax a little philosophical at this point, which is a total cop-out on some level, and point out that hopelessness and fearlessness are the same thing. There's no hope. There's no fear. Hope and fear are actually the passion and aggression. They're the key daily, everyday ploys in ego's game for maintaining ego's talk radio constantly, to which we are constantly listening, and which our melodrama is continuously being broadcast on. I can't spell out. I should spell out a little bit more about hopelessness, but it's difficult. You have to realize that as you surrender your reference point constantly, and even your dreams and occupations that you hang on to the most to insulate you from the rawness of the total openness of simply being there, that the bottom drops out gradually, or more rapidly, the bottom drops out, and there's a continual gap, which is like gaping gap, which is like deeply falling apart. You get it in episodes, and then it creates bigger episodes, and some people freak out, and people go through various numbers. Dips and trips of various kinds, which is necessary from the point of view of crazy wisdom or waking up. At this point, I'd like to give a bridge to this point number one we've been working on, which is dropping the reference point of ego. And hopelessness is connected with that. And so a bridge to point number two which is riding non-dual energy, is you have to understand that the Trikaya is operative in this very experiential every day, at least for a practitioner, every day sort of a ongoing process. And so it goes like this, that you, as I said before, you drop your reference point and there's a gap. There's a moment of total openness. Which is Dharmakaya. And Dharmakaya doesn't get to be any more than that. Anytime, anywhere, it doesn't get to be any bigger of a deal than that. That's it. That is Dharmakaya. And then as you examine your experience, you'll remember what comes after the gap is that some content begins to come in. Some energy begins to come in. Something begins to come in. And has the quality of, if you've dropped your reference point, good, if you've done it well, then it has what you begin to discover next has a fresh quality of energy and sense of discovery and seeing something. And that's Sambhogakaya. And then out of that, let's say this happens in middle of a situation, next thing that happens is you see, automatically you see how to deal with whatever content has come up. You spontaneously see some skillful means. And that's the Nirmanakaya. That's what's left, right? So, in the big picture, you get this energy of discovery. And somebody like a Buddha who we're talking about, like Padmasambhava, who does this extremely well, whose reference points drop completely, then after every gap, he's afresh, or she is a fresh, innocent babe. And the energy of discovery from the next moment of the Sambhogakaya can be extremely powerful and large. And then in dealing with the situation is where crazy wisdom begins to express itself, because when this is done on the Buddha level, that is a completely non-dual. And after the gap, when the content and energy flows in, it's like Buddha nature itself. It's absolute non-duality, which doesn't mean at all that it is devoid of content. There's plenty of content. There's plenty of play of energy and situations happening. But as we move, or as the Buddha moves onto the Nirmanakaya level, action becomes completely intentionless. The action is spontaneous. There's no dualistic strategy whatsoever. There's no strategy whatsoever, but it becomes the action of this crazy wisdom person becomes like the action of the elements. Fire, for example, is unintentional when it consumes fuel, when the conditions are met and it consumes fuel. If it destroys something, it's unintentional. It just happens. And so the crazy wisdom action is described as by Rinpoche as reacting spontaneously to the confusion existing around us in the phenomenal world, and merely producing a corresponding result totally without any intention of any kind. First of all, and it may be mirror-like. In any case, it responds. And the appropriate scriptural line is, he subdues what needs to be subdued. He destroys what needs to be destroyed. And he cares for whatever needs his care. And so in talking about this kind of stage of activity, strangely enough, the term that the Vidyadhara used a lot was ruthlessness. By the time I get to copping out, I'll tell you that ruthlessness and compassion are the same thing. But to begin with, he didn't particularly do that. But ruthlessness is the entire quality of refusing or no longer even being able to be drawn into dualistic strategies of any kind. And therefore, action that arises from that ruthlessness might appear to be extremely brutal sometimes. Sometimes quite loving, but overall quality is totally beyond compromise. So, I could go into that in my amateur way a little more, but instead of doing that, I've decided to conclude my end of this discussion, which I hope will continue lively fashion after I'm done. by reading a few passages on ruthlessness from Rinpoche's Crazy Wisdom Talks. And I think it's very fitting conclusion, since this is indeed our last talk of this particular course, to hear, which we haven't very much, some of the words of the boss himself, as we used to call him. So, in the case of the primordial craziness of crazy wisdom, we do not permit ourselves to get seduced by passion or aroused by aggression at all. We relate with these experiences as they are, and if anything comes up in the midst of that complete ordinariness and begins to make itself into a big deal, then we cut it down without any special reference to what is good and what is bad. Crazy wisdom is just the action of truth. It cuts everything down. It does not even try to translate falseness into truthfulness, because that in itself is corruption. Ask a question about that. It is ruthless, because if you want the complete truth, if you want to be completely wholly wholesome, then any suggestion that comes up of translating whatever arises into your terms, interpreting it in your terms, is not worth looking into. The usual crazy approach is completely up for that kind of thing, to make whatever comes up fit into your thing, suit what you want to be, suit what you want to see. But crazy wisdom becomes completely accurate out of the moment of things as they are. This is the style of the action of Padmasambhava. That's one. Anything is related to spiritual practice. This is another. That is ruthless in the sense that it knows nothing of hope and fear. And another. The whole point of ruthlessness is that when you are ruthless, no one can con you. No one can seduce you in an unhealthy direction. It is ruthlessness in that sense, rather than the illogical aggression of the conventional idea of ruthlessness, that of Mussolini or Hitler or someone like that. You cannot be conned or seduced, because you would not accept that. Even attempts to seduce you arouse energy that is destructive toward that attempted seduction. If you are completely open and completely aroused in terms of crazy wisdom, no one can lure you into their territory. Somebody asked the question, so you can maintain the ruthlessness, ... Rinpoche. You don't maintain the ruthlessness. Your ruthlessness is maintained by others. You don't maintain anything at all. You just be there, and whatever situation comes to you, you just project back. Take the example of fire. It does not possess its destructiveness. That just happens. When you put something in the fire or try to kill the fire, its offensive power just comes out. It is the organic or chemical nature of fire. Somebody asked another question. How does ruthlessness apply to the destruction of ego? Ruthlessness seems so uncompassionate, almost ego-like itself. Rinpoche, well, it is the ego's intensity that brings forth the, quotes, uncompassionate measures. In other words, when neurosis and confusion reach an extreme point, the only way to correct the confusion is by destroying it. You have to completely shatter the whole thing. That process of destruction is demanded by the confusion itself, rather than it being a question of somebody thinking it is a good idea to destroy the confusion by force. No other thinking is involved. The intensity of confusion itself demands its own destruction. Ruthlessness is just putting that energy into action. It is just letting that energy burn itself out, rather than you're killing something. You just let ego's neurosis commit suicide, rather than killing it. That's the ruthlessness. Ego is killing itself ruthlessly, and you are providing the accommodation for that. This is not warfare. You are there, and therefore it happens. On the other hand, if you are not there, there is the possibility of scapegoats and sidetracks of all kinds. But if you are there, you don't actually even have to be ruthless. Just be there. From the point of view of ego, that is ruthless. And the last one. The spiritual force of Padmasambhava, as expressed in his manifestation as Dorje Trolla, is a direct message that no longer knows any question. It just happens. There is no room for interpretations. There is no room for making a home out of this. There is just spiritual energy going on that is real dynamite. If you distort it, you are destroyed on the spot. If you are actually able to see it, then you are right there with it. It is ruthless. At the same time, it is compassionate, because it has all this energy in it. The pride of being in the state of crazy wisdom is tremendous, but there is a loving quality in it as well. Can you imagine being hit by love and hate at the same time? In crazy wisdom, we are hit with compassion and wisdom at the same time, without a chance of analyzing them. There is no time to think. There is no time to work things out at all. It's there. But at the same time, it isn't there. And at the same time also, it is a big joke. Aren't you glad that you heard that from him? And little point, which is an important point, is never forget that this crazy wisdom approach comes directly from Dharmakaya. It doesn't start from any kind of gradual build up. But comes directly from Dharmakaya, like Buddha does, which is the same exact way you do when you drop your reference point. Thank you. Yes, sir.
Thank you very much for that talk. Enjoyed it.
I'm delighted.
So that dropping or cutting through reference point brings one to hopelessness. And I know that Rinpoche used to tell people sometimes when they had an emotional state to go more deeply into it, just to go further into that emotional state. And I'm wondering, because I never had a lot of confidence in that as a teaching, and I'm wondering...
In dropping reference point?
How that relates to getting to that place of openness by going further into the emotional state that you're in, rather than, say, labeling as thinking.
Nobody ever particularly, as far as I understand, recommended going deeper into the emotional state or emotional goings on. It gets deep enough all by itself. Confusion produces a tremendous amount of going deep into that emotion all by itself. For instance, you just found out that your partner is sleeping with somebody else. You just realized that. You, any other of that sort of emotional upheaval produces a tremendous amount of intensity. The confusion produces it all by itself. There are, as I said in the beginning, various teachings for intensifying the sense of reference point. There's no need to intensify the confusion itself as such. All that stuff at the end that I read is about confusion doing that job for you, so that the crazy wisdom action is purely dancing with the confusion. And the crazy wisdom person is continually losing the reference point of duality anyhow. But we can always take the approach of dropping reference point. We don't have to work deeper into anything like that. Samsara is plenty fucking strong by itself. Bernardo.
Just to continue with that, he, in context of Maitri, mentioned leaning into the emotion. Uh-huh. And it seemed, my understanding of that was that you could pay attention to it. You know, you didn't have to take running away or suppressing it or acting on it. But there was kind of a little bit of tipping forward there of, you know, staying with it in a way.
I agree. Then and also, if you think about it, the instruction for Vajrasattva mantra, leaning into the sharp points, he used to, was one of his slogans. But leaning into it is different from taking an action of going into it more by, you know, strategically trying to make something out of it. Conceptually trying to make something out of it, leaning into it, has the effect of intensifying the sense of a reference point till it reaches the extreme where it pops. So you don't try to do any work like building with Legos inside the emotional thing. You don't try to work with it conceptually, but you lean into the reference point as it is. And I can't remember what quote, but you know, then it pops by itself. Somebody once asked Rinpoche about the realms. Have you ever been in the various other realms? And he said, "Yeah, I've been in all of them." You've been in hell? Definitely, you betcha, type of answer. He said, "What did you do?" He said, "I tried to stay there." So, you know, you have to. There's another thing which keys into this very much, which is the idea. One of the chapter titles in the Crazy Wisdom book, I'm afraid I made up the chapter titles, but it's a quote from within them, says, let the phenomena play. And the style of the Crazy Wisdom person, he explained, is not to apply an antidote, such as Padmasambhava might have in one case when I think it was I can't remember which king it was that was about to burn him at the stake, and in fact he did burn him at the stake. And Padmasambhava had obviously all kinds of powers that could have prevented him from being burned at the stake, but he just let himself be burned at the stake. And it just so happened that when the king came back a few days later, the whole scene of the burning had turned into a lake, and Padmasambhava was sitting on a lotus in the middle of the lake. I don't know if he was smoking a camel or... But, and he explained, you let the phenomena play, you let the confusion commit suicide by itself. So, in that sense, it's really important, what your point that you bring up is really important about staying with it, but... It's, at the same time, you have to have the background of willing, as soon as the reference point of ego makes itself obvious as such, to let it drop. It actually presents a little bardo in which the possibility of dropping is there. At that point, you have to drop. Another thing like this in the basic meditation instruction Rinpoche used to give for waking up from thoughts, which is the same thing. Obviously, you don't develop a police state regime of ego, of stopping your thoughts. It's obviously just another set of thoughts. So if you can't take ego action that way, if you can't take action that way, Rinpoche was asked, so what do you do? And he said, well, there's a tiny alarm clock, tiny alarm clock that goes off in the middle of your thing. You have to develop a very big ear. So that's the same sort of thing of letting the confusion solve the problem itself. Sure.
Excellent talk, Sher. Really good. One of the things that really struck me, and I was so delighted to hear you say it, is your reference to the basic sitting practice, which you just mentioned again,
mm-hmm.
which I'm finding being somewhat eroded as I've brought up several. I've been bringing it up a lot since I came back to Boulder.
Uh-huh. And is this going to be a political question?
No. Well, I don't know if political's the word. I think it's a crazy wisdom problem.
I see.
If it's being eroded, because what that technique, as you described it, uh-huh. does is plant the seed of crazy wisdom, and it also that moment of gap is also a moment of, you know, as you said, Dharmakaya. It's a moment of nature of mind. It's a moment of cosmic mirror. It's a moment of direct experience. Mm. And that is being somewhat withered away. And I guess what I'm getting at is that
Aaron, I'm afraid, I'm sorry to tell you, but that's totally indestructible.
Well,
it can't be withered away.
Well, the Dharma
that's the very quality
can't be withered
of it.
Away. The technique might be being withered or nibbled away at, more like nibbled at. In any event, the key words there, though, you said identify with or be the out-breath, go out and dissolve in space, leaving a gap. Then that, but that's setting a pattern for working with emotions. How did he suggest transmuting anger into mirror-like wisdom? Identify with or be the anger. And then that goes the next step with that identification with or be is like pride of the deity. Identify with or be the deity. And so those are the key words. And I think that one definition, I think this preceded those two Crazy Wisdom seminars. It was in Garuda 2 in that Working with Negativity article where he talks about that Crazy Wisdom is actually being able to feed on praise or blame equally. It's just yum because it's energy and food. Mm-hmm. You're not pushing one away, you know, like the critical stuff and just, you know, pulling towards you the positive stuff.
Yeah. It's that's why it's called crazy.
Delicious, right.
And I think even delicious.
Maybe that's too much of a value.
Yes, it is. It's too much of a
just
corruption.
It's food.
It isn't even food. It's energy. Just what it is.
Energy. Well, whatever.
Yeah.
But I think the thing, again, it's the same thing, that you identify with those situations, identify with them and be them, rather than pulling one towards you, pushing one away.
Yeah.
There was that importance of the sitting technique is what I'm getting at.
Uh-huh.
That is so important, and it's such a jewel.
Uh-huh.
And
okay, I don't want to hear any complaints.
Okay, that's enough. But it was good to hear you brought that up in this context.
Okay.
One last detail. I think the importance of this Crazy Wisdom teaching, I'll never forget the Vidyarta saying this, and it must have been at that second Crazy Wisdom seminar, The Tale of the Tiger, which I went to. I didn't go to the one at Jackson Hole.
Hmm.
I'll never forget this. It's like etched in my brain. I remember him saying this, that and with incredible sarcasm, Crazy Wisdom does not lead to happiness.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Clark.
Sure. Would you comment, if you can, with regard to your own experience about devotion with regard to Crazy Wisdom?
Can you give me a hint?
Hints didn't come along with the question. I'm sorry.
I see. Well, ruthlessness is devotion. In other words, real devotion is unconditional. And the unconditionality is both the object of the devotion and the operator of the devotion at the same time. And when that identity of unconditionality takes place, then Crazy Wisdom is just a something away, what do you call it? Crazy Wisdom, it's just, anyhow, it's Crazy Wisdom is not far away. Does that make sense?
Thank you.
Peter?
Mm-hmm. Sherub, sure, when you were doing the reading, you talked at one point about the corruption, and then you said there should be a question about it.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know what my question is, but I think you know.
Thank you. Well, it was similar to my... I'll read that sentence again if I can find it. Yeah. Crazy wisdom is just the action of truth. It cuts everything down. It does not even try to translate falseness into truthfulness, because that in itself is corruption. So that was a little bit my criticism with what you were saying, Cherub, about it being delicious. Stuff, you know, praise or blame, good or bad. It is true that pleasure and pain look alike, become ornaments, which are just pleasant to wear. But that's a very, very, very tricky point. You could easily turn that into some kind of, advanced form of spiritual materialism, or somewhat advanced form of spiritual materialism, by having a formula about that. The ruthless fact is that it is never softened by any approach like it had, any kind of spiritual, quotes, approach like that. It's always just as raw. The blame or the criticism is always just as raw and painful as it ever was, ever could have been. And exaltation of self-congratulation is just as gullible and goofy as it ever could have been. So that rawness remains, and trying to translate anything for as crazy wisdom and even falsehood into truth is corrupt because of that total ruthless, non-dual. For Buddha, it isn't even commitment, but for some level of us, it might be a commitment to things as they are, or non-duality. Trudy?
I'd like to try to have a less superficial understanding of what the big joke is. Because for me, it just sloughs everything off.
Great, that's it. That's it. That's beautiful. Congratulations. You just did it. Mazel tov. And that's the big joke.
Oh, man.
That is it. Isn't that wonderful? That'll be $5. Isn't that beautiful? Well, I hope that was somewhat helpful, and I hope the course has been somewhat helpful for you all. And I think we are we were going to have another session, but there was a schedule conflict and something had to be postponed, so this is it for now, but we'll try to come back with, we'll try to bring the circus back to town if we can. And right now, Peter is passing out a small questionnaire, an evaluation form, which if anybody would like to...
I know some people haven't been to too many classes. Some people have been to a lot of them, but whoever's moved to do so, it would be helpful for us if you could just give us a little bit of feedback on this. I have some pens if you need them. Thank you. Thank you all very much.
Clark wants to.
Just take a minute right now. Who's now in Chile? Also, a short to Errol, who's been working with Mark before this, and also with Tukone and Mike. I don't know your last name, I apologize. But for having dealt with the religious things, thank you very much.
Thank you both, Clark and Peter. You've been terrific. You should get some team shirts.